Andy Bauman of the DVE Morning Show. I'm Chris Rodell, and this is your Use All the Crayons podcast. And today we're going to be talking about elections, elections, elections. Well, not really, because first we're going to be hearing from Scott Levin, owner of the Youngstown Grill, and what is the most overlooked menu item at his restaurant. The restaurant's so close to the Tin Lizzie, I can almost smell the bacon. Then we're going to talk about a Bellingham, Washington tavern, where three thirsty notorious serial killers used to sip drinks before quenching more corpuscular cravings. Then, because I sense you can't get enough about current events, we'll delve into past thoughts about how to deal with elections.
And if it doesn't go well, we'll cut it.
Okay.
This is risk-free.
Okay.
I mean, there's no video either, which is nice.
Okay, good.
All right, go ahead. Say, this is Scott Levin from Youngstown Grill.
Okay.
This is the funniest line Chris has ever written.
Hey, this is Scott Levin from Youngstown Grill, and in my opinion, this is the funniest line that Chris has ever written. If most men are being honest, a big if, we'd admit to seeing a lot of ourselves in Ken while aspiring to see just a little of ourselves in Barbie.
That's your favorite?
That is my favorite.
What about the line, fans of the band The Grateful Dead are called Deadheads. What does that make those of us who revere the book Moby Dick?
Also a good one.
How about this one as a riddle? If the invisible man eats a visible hoagie, how far into the digestive system does it go before it disappears?
Yeah, that's not funny, but clever. It makes you think.
What's the best item here at the grill?
Well, for some odd reason, we're known for giant pancakes, but the best item here at the grill is probably a Reuben.
That's your favorite?
Yeah, that's what I think I do.
What's the one item that people don't order enough of that you think people should order? You'd like to get out there, like if you had a, say, come to the grill for this.
Something that's underrated here would probably be our chicken parmesan sandwich.
Yeah. What Arnold Palmer used to come here. What did he like to get?
French toast. He liked it so much that he asked for the recipe, and he started doing it at Bay Hill in Orlando.
Was he ever unruly here?
No.
Tell me the story about
Jerry a couple times.
Jerry. Tell me the story about when Tom Ridge was here with Arnold Palmer.
No, I saw that when we came in. I saw. Oh, I didn't know that.
Back in the beginning, about 8 years ago, things were very slow here. And on Sunday, which is now our busiest day, Arnold Palmer came in with Governor Ridge, and which is, you know, surprising and nice. And they were wearing on the lapel, they had the Arizona iced tea pins. And my son, who was probably 18 at the time, comes out and says, "Dad, those two guys are wearing Arizona iced tea pants." I'm like, "Well, that's because it's Arnold Palmer." and my son obviously was an artist and
yeah,
into music and very successful and not into sports whatsoever. But when he worked here, eventually Arnold got sick and we used to start delivering to his house. And my son realized him, what that meant and who he was, and definitely what he meant to the area. And he said on his Facebook, "I never post about my other job, which is the restaurant, but
cool.
I delivered to Arnold Palmer today."
Yeah.
So,
have you ever had any fights in here?
Other than me being involved? No.
When are you going to put Eggs Benedict on the menu?
Never.
Is that just to spite me?
Yes. Well, I don't believe in doing things incorrect, and I'm not set up to make that the proper way.
If you could own another kind of restaurant, what kind of restaurant would you own?
One that's only open 2 days a week.
What's the biggest pain in the ass about working here or running it?
The repetitiveness.
Yeah.
And the time put in. I'm never really off.
Yeah.
There's always work to do.
Is it rewarding when people tell you how much they like coming here?
Yes. And when people buy a t-shirt or or a hat or a mug, and it's very rewarding.
Yeah. I've been wearing Youngstown Grill shirts for a long time, and I've had people ask me if I own the restaurant.
And did you tell them yes?
I say I own the t-shirt. Anything else you want to say?
No, but no one's ever asked me if I wrote the books on the shelf.
Okay, I think that's it.
All right.
That's good. Now I'm going to sell you a calendar for the school play.
Well, they're expensive this year.
When news of the execution of D.C. sniper John Muhammad, people everywhere recalled a 2002 three-week reign of terror as diabolical as anything bin Laden can conceive. Not me. My first thought was of a warm, friendly tavern in the far northwest corner of the country. It was the Waterfront Seafood and Bar in Washington, in Bellingham, Washington. It's a place where everybody knows your name, and the odds of one of them killing you for sport far exceed the national average. I went there in 2003 after reading that the Waterfront was a real killer bar. Its regulars over the years included three notorious serial killers, Ted Bundy, Hillside Strangler Kenneth Bianchi, and Sniper Muhammad. And here's the hook. They were all good guys. They didn't cause trouble. They played well with others and remembered to tip their bartenders and waitresses. So what's the Waterfront's idea of a bad customer? That would be anybody who steals, breaks something, or starts a fight or dies during my shift, said then bartender Sherry Rookstool. As I noted in a story that ran in Esquire, there was no evidence, forensic or otherwise, that there were any bad customers there that night that I was there. That made them all suspect in the eyes of another bartender, Wally Oyen, who told me, Bianchi was the nicest guy in the world. That's why I wasn't surprised when Muhammad went nuts. Bianchi taught me that you just never know. Of course, no one was surprised when regular James A. Kenney was convicted in 1998 of beheading a woman. Now that guy was just a real asshole, Oyen said. How three notorious killers wound up regulars at the same friendly bar is a mystery. Best explanation came from bar regular John Riley. He said the bar's location is key. It's situated at the lowest point in a hilly town that's as far as anyone can run in America without leaving the country. Quote, restless troublemakers roll into town and then gravity brings them down to the waterfront, says Riley. A man likes to boast that he's the only man on earth who's been friendly with both Muhammad and Richard Saunders, son of Harrisburg, PA, Carnegie Mellon University graduate, the squirrely actor who played farm reporter Les Nessman on WKRP in Cincinnati, at least one of whom is among history's worst monsters. I remember reading posted signs advising proper conduct on everything from loitering, not allowed, to five detailed steps for check cashing, number two, locals only. There was nothing gently hinting at thou shalt not kill anyone who doesn't really have it coming. That's a pity because strangers invariably wind up immersed in gory discussions on how former waterfront patrons, now incarcerated in penitentiaries or hell, have combined to dispatch a minimum of 51 innocent souls. I spent a couple of hours there and sipped a few beers before saying my goodbyes. I haven't been back. It's the only bar in the world where even soda-sipping designated drivers are sure to leave with real killer hangovers. Colorful living tip. I tell prospective writers that the best way to stick it to the publishing industry is write a book and call it the big hands-on book of glues and other adhesives. That way every review will have to include the words, could not put it down. Story I wrote about pretending to be the last undecided voter in America. I wrote it in 2012 and have rerun it on my 8 Days to Amish blog every 4 years since then. Here it is. If I have the guts to pull it off, I'm pretty sure you'll hear about it, which means I'm pretty sure you won't. It's too bad, too, because I imagine it would be a dandy practical joke. Like all practical jokes, there's nothing practical about it. I do it because I think it would be funny. It would involve hours of standing, pained expressions, flop sweat, and torrents of relentless public ridicule. As I'm already a married father, I've got most of that down pat. See, this is the year of the undecided voter. Those of us with the ability to make up our minds, and apparently that's 99% of us, have endured 2 years and $2 billion of obnoxious ads trying to persuade about 1% of the electorate to vote for this one or that one. They say after all that, after the debates, ballyhooed jobless reports, and robocalls that, gee whiz, they just can't make up their minds. I want to be that guy. Few people understand the news media better than I. That's not as boastful as it sounds. Having worked for many of the most high-profile media organizations in the world, and been rejected by the rest, I have a unique grasp on what the media are seeking today. And did you notice how I use the grammatically correct media are instead of the commonly incorrect media is? Told you guys I knew my shit. I know that the biggest story of today, bigger than even who wins, is the identity of the undecided voter. Why'd they vote for who they did? Every news outlet will be camped outside of polling places all day trying to find these electoral kingmakers. And I have a plan that would ensure national exposure. Interested in that kind of publicity? Here's what you do. Walk into the voting booth and never leave. Camp there. Stay all day. Make them call the police to throw you out. The reason I probably won't do it is because I know all the people at my polling place, am shy about causing a scene, and fear my shenanigans would harm my shameless attempts to pump my books up. It's a pity because the past 8 years, our polling place has been at the local elementary school would have been perfect. We used to have those proper booths with the levers that pulled the drape shut behind you. The privacy made me feel secure. Now our voting booths are those little electronic stations that leave voters fully exposed. I spend my whole time glancing over my shoulder in fear that some angry Trumpster is going to see I'm voting the straight Democratic ticket and pound me over the head with a big bag of gold bars Sean Hannity advised him to buy. But the visibility in this scheme lends itself perfectly to my scheme. I'd walk in, say hello, sign my name, and be ushered to the voting station. It would be perfectly nondescript. Then time would tick by. 10 minutes, 30 minutes, an hour. Hundreds of voters will have come and gone, and I'll still be standing there. But I wouldn't be standing there still. No, it would be performance art of the highest level. I'd pace in a little circle. I'd look pensive. I'd look thoughtful. I'd look more anguished than James Dean in the scene from Rebel Without a Cause, where he falls to pieces screaming, "You're tearing me apart!" All of this would alarm the polling workers, who would clearly see they're dealing with an undecided voter. They wouldn't know what to do, so they'd call their supervisors. The media would show up to broadcast live reports of the man inside who can't make up his mind. Quote, "One official said this middle-aged man has spent 6 hours in the voting station," the reporter will say. "Sources say he spent 30 minutes doing eeny, meeny, miny, mo before bursting into tears. He remains truly undecided." For guidance and asking aloud questions to both candidates like they were floating there above my head. I'd ask the polling workers if it was against procedure to have someone deliver me a pizza. Interest would be at a fever pitch as the seconds ticked down. Every major network would be waiting outside to hear from how I'd voted. Then, with just moments to spare, I'd do what I'm guessing by now every still undecided voter in America is bound to do to settle this momentous matter. I'd flip a coin. It's election day, and it's tearing me apart! Remind people that one of the great oddities of the human existence is that many otherwise mature adults will answer in the affirmative when asked, "Do you want to see something really disgusting?" This in 2020, after that same election we're going through today, it seems like. You know what kind of gets to me? It kind of gets to me that calling me an idiot, a libtard, over policy disagreements just isn't mean enough. No, my earnest belief that the top 1% should pay their fair share in taxes means I belong to a secret cabal that preys on children by drinking their virgin blood, all for the glory of my satanic masters. Oh yeah, me and Tom Hanks. It's just utter nonsense. I mean, it's been years since I bumped into Hanks at one of the meetings. It was late last night and Val and I were watching the mind-numbing, razor-thin vote counts in rural Georgian counties where neither of us will ever set foot when we both blurted out the same sentiment at the same time. Can you imagine how much we'd have won by if he'd had just even once been a decent human being? Imagine. My fellow Americans, and I mean every one of you red and blue, I just want to say I'm sorry. I'm sorry for some of the tweets, the mockery, the incivility, and for all those misguided times I seem to go all buddy-buddy with the white supremacy boys. If you give me another chance, I promise I'll try harder to be less divisive. I'll try to be everyone's president. I'll try to be your president. Pinky promise. He wouldn't even have to be sincere. Just say something like that, and we know it would have been even close. Trump would be victorious and would be entitled to honestly brag about receiving the most votes in electoral history. He'd have held on to the Senate and expanded GOP seats in the House. And you Trump supporter, how would you feel? You'd be feeling euphoric. You'd feel like dancing a happy jig. And you'd feel like gloating about how guys like me were morbidly morose on our prospect in the next 4 more years. In short, you'd feel like I feel. And I'm feeling pretty good. See, I don't really care about the GOP holding on to the Senate, gaining seats in the House, or gubernatorial victories in square states out west where they bury all the toxic waste. Although I do admit to feeling a little charged anytime I get to type the word gubernatorial. To me, this was all about Trump. You too, I suspect. I hate him. Hate him for all the reasons you may revel in him. Hated him ever since he mocked that disabled reporter. Of course, me being a somewhat disabled, somewhat reporter, I'm somewhat biased. But know this, my brothers and sisters, I do not hate you, at least not those of you who do not hate women, browns, blacks, L's, B's, G's, Q's, etc. Yes, I'm one of those liberals who hates people who hate. I call it Rodell's hatred paradox. But as we've careened through this most god-awful year, one riven with tumult and you mocking me for even wearing stylish masks, I've tried to slice through the bitter din and understand you. On this mission, I have failed. I cannot understand what makes anyone from the party of my proud father support Trump. The notion gave rise to the nifty line, the revulsion true Republicans feel at the idea of supporting a man like Trump must be akin to what dying vegetarians feel when they realize they're about to turn zombie. So 4 years of Trump would have both been without some silver linings. I may not understand you, but I truly understand we are at some point going to need to understand one another. I'm friends with and admirers of too many of you to simply dismiss you as a bunch of kooks and bigots. Take, for example, this one very bright woman who said that there was so much she detested about Trump, she was so ardently pro-life, her Catholic guilt meant she felt compelled to vote for him. Besides, she said, I can tell Joe Biden has dementia. What makes her such a mental know-it-all? She's my neurologist. She's a brain doctor. It might sound like crazy talk, but I believe we can somehow reconcile our differences. We must. Because at just this moment, there are 71.6 million Americans like me who are mostly ecstatic that Trump lost. But there's 68 million Americans who are mostly furious that Biden won. And we're stuck because we're all in this together. And I don't mean that in a rah-rah USA, USA, all in this together way. I mean it like we're cellmates. Cellmates in an insane asylum. So that's all for this week. I hope you'll join me next week when we can together begin to heal the country by talking about something, anything that does not involve politics. In fact, let's start right here with a conclusion that's geared to something I wouldn't think it would be all controversial, but geez, you just never know. Colorful living tip of the day. Because of the noisy commotion associated with the happy event, I propose we change the word orgasm to roargasm. That's roargasm.